Hello, this is Dr. Narala Jacoby, and today we are mapping sulfur-reducing bacteria on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-minute matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, I'll be speaking with Dr. Narala Jacoby. Dr. Jacoby graduated from Bastyr University in 1998 with a doctorate in naturopathic medicine. She practiced as a primary care physician in Montana for 7 years before moving to Australia. Narala is considered one of Australia's leading experts in the treatment of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. She's the medical director of SIBO-Test, an online testing service for practitioners. And she's so passionate about educating practitioners that she founded the SIBO Doctor, an online professional educational platform. Narala lectures nationally and internationally about the assessment and treatment of SIBO and is the host of the popular podcast, The SIBO Doctor Podcast, which you will see linked in the show notes. She's the medical director and senior naturopathic physician at the Biome Clinic, Center for Functional Digestive Disorders in Mullumbimby, New South Wales, Australia. Welcome, Dr. Jacoby. I'm so pleased to have you here.
My pleasure, Andrea.
We are talking about a subject that I know is so important to so many practitioners. We're seeing more and more SIBO in our practices, and we're going to be talking today about sulfur-reducing bacteria. So I'm wondering if you can start us out by defining what that is and how it appears.
Sure. So the reason why sulfur-reducing bacteria are important to practitioners is that it is a cause of SIBO, and it's also very often a cause of constipation or chronic constipation in our patients. Interestingly, it can cause diarrhea in the upper gut, so in the case of SIBO, as Dr. Pimentel just mentioned, and but more constipative issues in the lower gut. So sulfur-reducing bacteria, the two main ones are desulfovibrio group, there's a few of them, and Bilophilia wadsworthia. So these two organisms actually use a particular pathway called the dissimulatory sulfate reduction pathway to actually produce hydrogen sulfide. There are other bacteria that use a different type of pathway that are not as strong. They don't produce as much hydrogen sulfide, but they can also do that. And they're more the Streptococcus, Salmonella, Enterobacter, and also Helicobacter. So there's different pathways to produce hydrogen sulfide. And the interesting thing about hydrogen sulfide is that in small doses, it can actually be beneficial. There's some research into actually formulating a medication with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories with hydrogen sulfide, because it actually can have in low amounts anti-inflammatory effects, but in much higher amounts it can have the opposite effect, and it can cause DNA damage, and it can affect motility, and your patient can have multiple also systemic symptoms of myalgias and body aches. So it's an important gas to know about.
I was going to ask you, and you're speaking into this a little bit, if in certain sort of doses or in the population, in some ways it can be commensal until it's overgrown. And I'm wondering if you can speak more into what are the conditions in which these particular bacteria do get overgrown.
Hydrogen sulfide is is also endogenously made. So we know it's an important gasotransmitter, as we call them. So it's a gas that can have many functions in the body. So we are producing it. So it's important.
Yes.
And there are some schools of thought that say that any kind of hydrogen sulfide production by bacteria in the gut might be a compensatory mechanism, but that may be outside the scope of this podcast. But for the for all intents and purposes, the favorable conditions for the production of hydrogen sulfide is where we have more of an alkaline stool, and there's a lot of substrate, meaning a lot of sulfur as a substrate. And obviously, you have to have these sulfur-reducing bacteria on board. So, and in, as the case with SIBO, SIBO is more of a condition where motility is really the is often the problem, mm-hmm. and then you can have overgrowth of bacteria as a result of that. Not as much as in the large intestine that has other causes, but yeah, so you can have different conditions in the colon that can be favorable for the overgrowth of sulfur-reducing bacteria. The other important thing is that these bacteria are very, very resistant to antibiotics and antimicrobials, so they are a little bit tougher to treat.
How do you go about determining if these bacteria are present, or do you are you able to see by the signs and symptoms alone that these bacteria are part of the problem?
Well, traditionally with breath testing, what we've been able to do is just looking at the pattern of hydrogen and methane. If there's a flatlining result in both more in hydrogen, we can deduce that it might be possible that, or it might be the case that hydrogen sulfide is being produced. Because for the we've not had the ability to test for hydrogen sulfide with the breath tracker machinery.
Right.
It's coming very soon. It's not available to every lab, but the technology has finally caught up. So we will be able to measure hydrogen sulfide in the very, very near future.
And are you seeing that when these sulfur-reducing bacteria are present, that constipation is always an issue and has always been an issue, or has been an issue for some time? You were speaking into the motility actually being a trigger, and I'm assuming a mediator, for the occurrence of the overgrowth of bacteria. So is it 100% of the time with the sulfur-reducing bacteria that constipation is present?
No, it's not. And just to kind of go back to your last question about assessment, I do a lot of microbiome assessment, mm-hmm. meaning stool testing, which is not a good measure for small intestinal overgrowth at all. But I often look at the large intestine as another contributing factor for what's happening in the digestive process in a patient.
Mm-hmm.
So I use labs that measure desulfovibrio. Bilophilia. So those are important bacteria to look for. So sometimes what's interesting is that you can have a situation where you have of constipation where you have overgrowth of either sulfur-reducing bacteria or methane or Methanobrevibacter smithii. Those are the two organisms that can cause constipation, and they're usually not high at the or elevated at the same time. So that can happen where you can have a constipated patient and it's one of those that's causing the constipation, but not both together. I have seen it both together, but it's more the exception rather than the rule.
I see. And, you know, when we're thinking about looking for the roots and going back and sort of doing a detailed timeline for these patients, has constipation been present somewhere along the way, even if it's not present in the presenting case? Or are you seeing other contributing factors that tend to be have been present when we see the overpopulation of these sulfur-reducing bacteria?
Well, I can't say that there is a very clear pattern that's mm-hmm. emerged as far as causative factors of why a patient may have an overgrowth of them. Because, I mean, there are dietary factors. If somebody really over-consumes sulfur-containing foods, meaning eggs and red meat and sort of like on a very, very high protein diet, it's conceivable that you're favoring the growth of those organisms. But because they are sulfur-loving and they're also fat- and dairy-loving and bile-loving. So if you have a very, like, let's say a ketogenic diet or
right.
so, and you have already a propensity towards those organisms, then it's conceivable that you're actually feeding them. But that's not always as straightforward, but you are promoting, if you will, the growth of those bacteria.
Yeah.
So if you have a patient that gets much worse, for example, on a diet that's very high in these foods, then it's likely or it's possible that you have an overgrowth of these organisms.
Thanks. I was trying to nail that. Like, what is it that are the contributing factors? And it sounds like there are myriad possibilities that could lead to the overgrowth of these bacteria. So yeah, that's interesting to think about, because even these diets that we think of as healing diets or that are promoted as healing diets could be contributing to dysbiosis and lead to downstream diagnoses. So are the symptoms that we see from these particular bacteria secluded to the GI function, or are you seeing immune imbalances, oxidative stress, detoxification? Are you seeing other issues manifest when these bacteria are in overgrowth?
That's a really good question, because I don't think we really know enough yet of all the effects of hydrogen sulfide, because it is an endogenous gasotransmitter. So we are also producing hydrogen sulfide. And I think when we look at genomic and methylation issues, where we have CBS pathways or deficiencies or SNPs in that area, then it's conceivable that if you have a lot of hydrogen sulfide production endogenously or exogenously, that could possibly overwhelm these detoxification pathways. And then we can see the resulting symptoms of that. Generally, we do, if we have a patient that has very, very high levels of hydrogen sulfide, it's not uncommon to hear that they have body aches, mm-hmm. rashes, joint pain, sort of those types of systemic symptoms. But yes, it's also very much associated with oxidative stress and so forth. It's not like a clear-cut pattern of everybody has those symptoms, but if you do have that in a constipated patient, it might really be helpful to look for those bacteria on a stool test.
Yeah, this is the issue that we see with SIBO, which is why the work you're doing is so important, because it's not so straightforward. There is more antibiotic and antimicrobial resistance. In best case scenario, in working with somebody with these particular bacteria, what does that look like from a treatment arena?
What I've been doing, and this is, you have to understand that I see patients that have pretty much failed other digestive treatments.
Yes.
And so I see very, very difficult cases and people that have self-restricted their diet to just five foods or so because they're so reactive. So one of the first things I do, let's say that a patient comes in with chronic constipation, they are negative on a SIBO test or breath test. And so I've done a stool test. And I see really classic patterns of not just dysbiosis, but elevated sulfur-reducing bacteria. And I might see very, very low short-chain fatty acids because they've self-restricted their diet so severely. And so what I may actually do is change their diet completely to a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. Let's say they come in on a very high protein and high fat diet. So I might just completely take out those foods for a period of time, for about 4 to 6 weeks. It's not like this has to be done forever. And this is also not help. You know, some people still will react, but in that case, I will increase very strain-specific probiotics. So I use a lot of Lactobacillus plantarum, and I use bismuth and zinc acetate. And so rather than going straight into antimicrobials, I try to reduce the substrate, so fat and protein and sulfur. So I go on a low sulfur diet, or I have the patient go on a low sulfur diet and for a period of time. And I might give them molybdenum and, like I said, zinc acetate and bismuth to help clear excessive hydrogen sulfide from their system. Bismuth is a binder and so is zinc acetate.
Mm-hmm.
So it might just help to reduce the substrate and the final end product of hydrogen sulfide to alleviate their symptoms. And very often when you change a patient's diet to a vegan diet just for a period of time, I've seen really dramatic turnarounds in a relatively short period of time. But that can, you know, you have to assess that on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I would imagine that some of these patients have difficulty with the change in fiber because they haven't even been eating that much fiber. And I'm mm-hmm. also curious just about their sort of resilience related to the hormones and the neurohormones because they're under so much stress internally.
In terms of hormones, I deal mainly with adrenal hormones.
Right.
And as you mentioned, stress, and very often we see a low SIG-A in patients that have chronic stress and so forth. And yes, that's always in the back of my mind in terms of how to balance these patients out. But I often do, in really, really tough cases like that, I might suggest gut-centered hypnotherapy, which has shown to be very effective in many IBS patients, and something like 70 to 80% improvement long-term. So this is something that I often utilize to down-regulate the sympathetic nervous system that that's sort of really over-present in the enteric nervous system in these patients.
Any other things that you can share with us in particular about the sulfur-reducing bacteria?
When it comes to practitioners really being able to interpret the PCR microbiome assessments through the CDSAs that we're ordering, I think it's really important for us as practitioners to be really at the forefront of the research there, because there's a lot of microbiome research, of course, coming out. And we don't really yet know the interplay between these different organisms. And if it's really true that a patient might have an upregulated hydrogen sulfide production from their desulfa vibrio, but perhaps they have some internal need for hydrogen sulfide. We don't understand those connections yet. Is there an endogenous need when sulfur-reducing bacteria are upregulated? And I don't have the answer for that. But I do see people get better when we treat overproduction of hydrogen sulfide. And that might just be temporary, and it's not my goal to completely eliminate sulfur-reducing bacteria. So that whole approach of killing that organism is not my approach when I'm dealing with these patients. It's not a pathogen. It's a normal organism that is just dysbiotic and overgrown potentially. So I'd say aim to manage and reduce symptoms and bring a balance to the system rather than try to eliminate this organism.
That final point, Dr. Jacoby, was so important for us to hear, that it's not about eradication, it's about balance and management. That's so often the case when we're looking at GI issues. And I want to thank you for joining us and shining that light on the subject.
My pleasure. Thanks again for inviting me.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like us to notify you each time there's a new podcast episode ready, please go to 15minutematrix.com/notify and let us know. We'll drop into your inbox with a short reminder that a new episode is ready for you. Plus, I always want to hear what you're interested in hearing. Drop us a line and let us know who you'd like to hear interviewed on the podcast or what you'd like to see mapped on the 15-Minute Matrix. You can always reach us at ask@15minutematrix.com. That's ask@15minutematrix.com.